Okay, picture this if you can. It's pitch black, dead of night in Vietnam. You're in a small outpost, and suddenly, you're not just fighting off soldiers, but actual tanks
Yeah.
rolling right through the wire.
It's the kind of scenario that sounds almost unbelievable, but it was terrifyingly real for the guys at Lang Ve, a U.S. Special Forces camp.
And that's what we're diving into today. We've got this incredible firsthand account from YouTube, Episode 6, The Battle of Lang Ve. Someone who was actually there.
Yeah, it's raw, intense stuff, gives you a real ground-level view of just utter chaos and incredible bravery.
So let's set the scene a bit. We're talking late 67, right? October-ish,
Yep.
Lang Ve camp rebuilt.
Exactly. Near Highway 9, which, everyone knew as the Ho Chi Minh Trail, super close to the Laotian border.
And his job was basically twofold, running recon patrols, long-range stuff, and defending the camp itself.
Right. But the defenders, they weren't your standard mix. You had U.S. Special Forces, the Green Berets.
Working alongside the Mike Source, and these were the Montagnards.
Yeah, local tribesmen, fierce fighters, really need the terrain. Initially, there were some, cultural bumps. They were kept kind of separate.
But the reality on the ground kind of forced them together.
Absolutely. When things got real, they became a unified fighting force. They had to.
Now, the intel picture. That sounds like a mess. They knew something might happen.
Sort of. The NSA picked up chatter about a possible attack, maybe around the New Year Tet timeframe. But, and this is the kicker,
No tanks.
not a word about tanks. Zero warning about armor, which obviously turned out to be catastrophic.
And then there's this whole other layer of weirdness with the Laotians.
Oh, yeah. The 33rd Laotian Battalion, get this. They were apparently working for both sides, State Department, CIA, and the NVA.
Seriously, how does that even work?
Well, it created huge distrust, as you can imagine. There was this incident where a U.S. lieutenant almost got court-martialed, basically,
For what?
for disarming some of these Laotians who turned up with brand new AK-47s. Suspicious, right? And this lieutenant, he's going to be right in the middle of the Lang Ve fight.
Wow. Okay. And then there was that mission near Kasan, looking for John Young.
Right, a failed recon mission, technically. But here's the crazy part. During that, a Montagnard company stumbled upon and basically wiped out an entire NVA battalion.
Whoa. Okay, huge confidence boost for the Mike Force, I bet.
Definitely. But it probably also tipped off the NVA about just how effective these guys were and that they were inside Lang Ve. Unintended consequences.
So the NVA knew the Mike Force was there.
And according to their own after-action reports, which our source talks about, that changed everything. The tanks they used on Lang Ve, they were originally meant for Kisan.
No way. So they diverted the tanks specifically because the Mike Force was in Lang Ve.
Seems like it. Once they knew who was inside, Lang Ve became the priority target for that armor. Suddenly, it wasn't just some outpost, it was a threat they needed to crush.
Okay, so that really sets the stage. Night of February 6th, the narrator is setting up listening posts.
Yeah, routine stuff. No idea what's about to hit them. Completely unaware of the tanks massing just outside.
And episode 6, our source, really dives into what happened next. That initial shock.
And the NVA intel. It was disturbingly good. They had drawings of the camp layout.
Like accurate drawings.
Unnervingly accurate. Showed the mortar pits, the four deuce positions, almost as good as the defenders' own maps. Their sappers, those recon guys, they did their homework. Sneaky and effective.
Which explains how they planned the attack so well. Five tanks down Route 9.
And three more coming across the Sapan River at Lang Troi using an underground bridge.
An underground bridge. How do you even hide that?
Exactly. Total surprise attack vector. Imagine seeing tanks pop up where you thought it was impossible terrain.
And hadn't the camp been getting shelled regularly already, leading up to this?
Yeah, for weeks, every day around 5 p.m., like clockwork. It caused damage, sure, but maybe also a bit complacency. You get used to the
Well,
rhythm.
plus they had civilians there, a lot of them.
Around 2,200 Laotian civilians, yeah. Sick,
Yeah.
seeking refuge. Adds another layer of complexity and strain on resources.
Then the call comes in, midnight.
Yeah. The phone rings in the command bunker, the guard's voice, chillin', just, we got tanks in the wire.
Just like that. Five words, and everything changes.
Instantly, flares go up, mortars start firing, trying to see, trying to hit something in the dark.
And the first tank just
Yeah.
appears.
Yeah, just one initially. No infantry with it, which seemed odd. Maybe they were overconfident or just moving really
So our
fast.
narrator, the lieutenant, he grabs a law,
Yeah.
the anti-tank weapon.
Right. And tries to fire, misfire, tries again, misfire again. You can just feel the panic rising.
Oh, man. but he finally gets one off.
Yeah, it gets a hit. Doesn't punch through the armor, but it definitely gets the tank crew's attention. They swivel that main gun right towards his position.
Yikes. Time to move.
Absolutely. The tank fires, hits near their mortar pit. They scramble out just in time. Then the colonel steps up.
The colonel himself?
Yep. Takes out the second tank with two little love you rounds. Successful hit. Huge moment, but more tanks are coming.
So the lieutenant gets back in the fight.
Yeah.
Against the third and fourth tanks.
Exactly. Uses his remaining laws. Has another misfire. Incredibly frustrating. But manages to take out both the third and fourth tanks. Their anti-tank ammo must be running seriously low now.
Meanwhile, the infantry assault. How are the Montagnards holding up?
Amazingly well. Our source stresses this. For most of the initial fight, until maybe the last half hour, no NVA infantry got inside the wire. The Montagnards held that perimeter fiercely.
Incredible. Even against regular NVA soldiers.
Totally. They were fighting for their homes, their land. There's this story of a wounded Montagnard company commander still trying to coordinate, just asking for a medevac for his guys, not wanting to leave. True grit.
But eventually, the perimeter starts to break down. They have to fall back.
Yeah, things are getting overrun. They retreat to the Tactical Operations Center, the TOC, the bunker. They call it the TOC.
The last stand location. Underground, concrete. Should be safe, right?
You'd think. But the MBA went right for it, targeted the generator first. Boom! Lights out, comes out, pitch black, 5 feet underground.
And the antenna's on top.
Destroyed, too. Complete isolation. And then the assault on the bunker itself began.
What did they throw at it?
Everything. Satchel charges blowing up against the concrete. Incendiary grenades, white phosphorus, the smoke, just horrible, toxic.
WP in an enclosed space, deadly.
And then the flamethrower, trying to burn them out. The bunker itself caught fire. Our narrator describes desperately trying to find pockets of air, gasping, just unimaginable.
And the radio operator, Frankie Dooms.
Yeah.
Still trying to get help.
Yeah, sending out these desperate calls, you can hear the sheer hopelessness in the account from episode 6. Just pleading for support.
Did air support show up?
Eventually, yeah. Zip Rouser, the FAC, and A1 Sky Raiders. Those tough old prop planes. But the clouds were really low, making it super dangerous for them to operate.
But they tried anyway.
They were determined. But then, another terror. Grenades started coming down into the bunker.
Down? How?
Through an air vent. The NVA were right on top of them. The lieutenant actually fired his rifle up through the vent, trying to hit whoever was throwing them.
Insane. Just layers of nightmare.
Then, a huge explosion. An airstrike right on top of the bunker.
Friendly fire.
Almost. It was incredibly close. A deliberate choice by the pilots. They knew they couldn't use napalm. It would have cooked everyone inside. So they used conventional bombs.
Did it work?
It scattered the NVA on top. Gave the guys inside a crucial breather, a chance to put out fires, clear some smoke, amazing flying, incredible risk.
Okay, so the immediate threat on the bunker is pushed back. Now's the time for rescue, right?
Yeah.
Key San is close.
You'd think so. Captain Willoughby gets through to the Marine Command at Key San. Colonel Lounge via another Colonel Allen.
Reinforcements coming.
No. Flat refusal.
What? Why?
The reason given was expected casualties for the rescue force would be too high, even though Key San was just, 5 miles away?
5 miles?
Yeah.
And they just said no.
Wow.
I can't even imagine being in that bunker, hearing that news.
Devastating. The reaction, as our source describes it, just pure anger, disbelief, and then this grim resolve. Okay, we're on our own.
The narrator describes a really personal moment then, doesn't he? Preparing for the end.
Yeah, really raw. Took off his dog tags, cut up his ID card, kept one bullet for himself, said a prayer. You really feel the weight of that moment, facing death.
But he doesn't give up. He decides they have to break out.
He does. He confronts the medic, Moreland, who's wounded and understandably losing it a bit. The lieutenant just decides we're going out.
And the others agree to leave the burning bunker and make a run for it.
Against all odds, yeah. They decide to follow him out. A collective decision. Born from desperation.
First things first, though. Destroy the sensitive stuff.
Right. Burn the crypto materials. Can't let that fall into enemy hands. Then the climb out. The bunker's damaged. It's not easy.
And the Sky Raiders are still overhead.
Still providing cover. Doing these wet runs, simulated attacks to keep the NVA heads down.
Yeah.
Then a dry run. No bombs dropped, which was the signal. Go time.
So they merge into what? Chaos.
Total chaos. Gunfire everywhere. The lieutenant immediately starts directing the wounded behind some barrels for cover. Just instinct taking over.
And they learned about Eugene Ashley then.
Yeah, the brave sergeant major who'd tried so hard to reach them earlier. He didn't make it. killed trying to save them.
God, okay, they're moving, trying to escape.
And they run right into two NVA soldiers looting bodies. Lieutenant raises his rifle.
Yeah.
It jams. His rifle jams at the worst possible moment. And as he's trying to clear it, he twists his ankle badly, pops it. He's down.
Oh, no. So the others, they have to leave him.
They have to keep moving. He's injured, exposed. It looks like the end for him right there.
But then something happens. The Sky Raider.
Yeah, this is where the story takes another incredible turn, and A1 comes screaming in, impossibly low, right over him, and the pilot dips his wings.
Signal. Like, I see you.
Seems like it. Huh? A gesture of solidarity, encouragement, and then silence. Utter silence. No guns, no planes, nothing.
Eerie.
And the narrator describes this profound, almost mystical experience. A bright light, a voice, an internal struggle. Give up or live. He chooses to live.
And his rifle.
His rifle unjams.
Just like that.
Unbelievable. He gets up, despite the angle, starts moving again, makes it to a crest line, and his men see him, recognize him.
The relief must have been immense.
Totally. They reach the rendezvous point, and he just collapses from exhaustion, pain, everything. But they're not safe yet. Then they hear it. Helicopters.
Rescue finally arriving. Army slicks. Marines.
Both. Army Hueys, Marine CH-46s circling. The LZ isn't secure, still risky, but this one Army slick pilot just decides to go for it.
Takes incredible guts.
Absolutely. Tim Kirk, who was on a later bird, talked about jumping off and helping haul the wounded aboard that first slick. It was frantic.
Just grabbing people, getting them on. Montagnards, too.
Yeah, pulling the Mike Force guys on. Chaos. Amidst it all, the lieutenant finds his Montagnard counterpart. A quick moment of connection in the madness.
And Ray, the other survivor mentioned, his flight out was rough, too.
Oh, yeah. They stopped to refuel at Kisan and took heavy fire on the ground. He talked about seeing civilians desperately clinging to the skids as they took off again.
Okay, trying to escape.
Yeah, and they had to forcibly remove one mid-flight because the helicopter was struggling. Just brutal choices. His helicopter was shot up pretty bad, but somehow it held together.
Miraculous that any of them made it out.
Truly. The survivors were eventually reunited, forged this incredible bond, obviously. Three guys were taken prisoner, released in 73. All the missing in action were eventually accounted for, except one.
Danny Phillips.
Yes.
Still missing.
Still missing. A final sad reminder of the cost.
Lengve.
Yeah.
The story in episode 6, it's a testament to courage against absolutely impossible odds, isn't it?
It really is. Resilience, leadership, when everything's falling apart, the human cost is just staggering, but so is the will to survive.
It shows you where people find strength, maybe in places they didn't expect. That bond between the U.S. guys and the Montagnards.
Exactly. And the determination of those pilots, it highlights survival, leadership, bravery, all of it. And it's why remembering these stories, honoring these veterans, is so important.
So when you hear an account like this, firsthand, from someone who lived through that hell, it makes you think, doesn't it?
Definitely. It poses that question. What does it really mean to face impossible odds? What can we learn from people who stared into the abyss and somehow found a way back?
Something to really ponder. It definitely encourages you to learn more about these battles, these soldiers, these allies, their experiences during the Vietnam War.